This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
All right, welcome back, all you players, playerettes, dudettes, amigos, amigas, everybody in between. So part one with Tim Stommel, we kind of set the stage for this. You heard about his background. Dude can't hold a job. He's moved around every 3 years. He's like a fugitive. We're just talking about fugitives. Murph is like, I can't stay in one place very long, man. Moving targets harder to hit. I got to keep moving. So,
hey, but you know, I got to say, man, it's in DEA. If you're moving like that, because I did the same thing, you're taking promotions, you know, trying out different things around the world. It's like becoming a gypsy about every 2 or 3 years, even now in retirement. You know, we just moved to Florida last year. It's like you're ready to go. You're ready. And my wife's the same way. You know, you're ready to pick up, try something
new. You go through Murph's house. He still has shit in boxes. He's like, we may be moving at any moment now. I'm not going to unpack that stuff.
And that's true. That's actually true. I still got all my beer mugs from college.
I've got a Peloton bike, and I'm in the Peloton military vets group. And there's one guy on there, they call him Ranger in a Kilt, Steve Melians. Guy was a badass. I mean, Ranger saw action, jumped out of planes, did all that shit. And that's all he does is wear kilts now. Well, he was an E-8 when he retired. His wife is still in active duty and an officer. She's getting moved around. Since I've been in this group with him for like 3 years, this is his third move in 3 years.
Jeez. All right. It sounds like he can't hold a job or he's trying to outrun the law.
No, it's his wife. It's like the Army is moving her to this command post and then she's going to training here and then doing that. It's like the only people making money out of this are the movers that work for the federal government.
There you go. It's a good job if you can get it.
That's right. Well, hey, let us get back now into part two, because part one was really setting the stage. We learned about you. We learned about the groundwork that was laid. Group four now. So you're in group four. And so how did this investigation, we're going to call it Queen of the Pacific because it's just kind of a neat title. But I mean, it's a major operation, like you said, though, and it's got lots of players. So start laying the groundwork. When did this thing start hitting your radar? How did this come about?
Yeah, so what happened was before I got to Miami, couple of guys in the group were working a case. I think it started back in like June of 99. And they had a target there, this guy Andres Lopez, that they were investigating. I think they went up on a Title 3. They saw he was involved with some Mexican cocaine organizations. And they were intercepting his phone. And through that intercept, they identified another guy out in Los Angeles, this guy Carlos Pena. So these were really the two main targets in their case. And again, this was before I got there. They spun Los Angeles up on a Title 3 telephone intercept on Pena. And based on the intercepts they got, I think it was a dry conspiracy. I don't think they had any seizures. So it was a conspiracy charge with no drugs really on the table. But they indicted Pena and Lopez in Miami. So that was two indictments that Miami had. And it kind of ended there. I think Miami backed off. That was kind of an investigation. So it was an ongoing case, but it wasn't really being actively worked. A few months later, I think it was Los Angeles, a task force officer out there, reinvestigated Carlos Pena and started a new wire intercept on Carlos Pena out in California. And that's when they found that Carlos Pena actually hired this guy, Carlos Restrepo, to fly from Los Angeles to New Jersey, and he was going to be transporting some heroin. And that's where really this case you're going to see picked back up is it was this guy.
Well, let's bookend that real quick too. So you got on, DEA when, and then when did you move to Miami?
I got on DEA in 97 and in 2000, I moved to Miami. So I did 3 years in DC and now this was the fall of 2000 in Miami.
All right. So you've only been on DEA for 3 years. You're in Group 4 now. And this case kind of starts picking back up. Like you say, it was like a dry hole. I mean, what you called a dry conspiracy. Had conspiracy, but no dope ever got seized because of this. But it kind of went dead. But now it's picking back up again, right? So you have just been assigned to Group 4 when this thing starts picking back up?
Yeah. And fortunately, a couple of the agents in the group had this old case. They had other cases going on. So they did me a favor. You know, you go into a new office, right? You don't have any informants. You don't have any cases. So you really need some help to get going. So these guys handed me this case to run with. And the reason they handed it back to me was this guy Restrepo ended up getting hit in when he landed in New Jersey coming from L.A. He got popped. I think it was with 1.5 kilos of heroin, but he was carrying a Miami cell phone. It was a 786 cell phone, and that's where it came back to us now. And they let me run with this case, looking at this guy.
So this was now. What year was this?
This was in 2000, December of 2000.
So 1.5 kilos of heroin, a Colombian heroin. Was it Mexican or Colombian?
Probably Mexican. It probably originated though in Colombia at the time. It was coming through Mexico, but probably a good chance it was Colombian heroin.
And so by this time, heroin is pretty prevalent in the United States, right?
Yeah, Miami, that's pretty much all we were working. My 7 years in Miami was heroin coming through.
Which is just, it's unbelievable. I mean, it went from coke to heroin and, coke to heroin.
I was going
to
say, how much was a kilo of heroin at that time, if you remember?
Oh, geez, I think it was up around 36,000.
But yeah, that's so equivalent for a kilo of coke, right?
Or no. You know what? I can't even remember. No, I can't even remember back then.
That would be a little bit high for a kilo of coke. But if you think back, you know, when heroin was king, when the Southwest and Southeast Asian heroin coming into New York City and the Northeast, kilos were going for like $250,000 for 1 kilo. And now all of a sudden you get the Mexicans producing, the black tar, the brown heroin and some white. Then you got the Colombians who have perfected it and they're producing Colombian heroin. And they were able to cut the price down to $50,000 just to start with. I mean, it went for several years. You couldn't even get Asian heroin in the United States because there was no money in it for them.
Yeah, I may have misquoted there. It may have been up around 60, 70. I can't even remember. Yeah, I can't remember.
It's been a long time on that time, and I'm sure you're missing your afternoon nap, but that's okay.
He's not the only one who gets cranky when they don't get their nap.
Damn right. Don't piss me off.
Right. So they, but like you say, you're a new agent. You got to develop a case. So is the reason they gave it to you because they thought it was a dry hole, like you're not going to get anything out of this? Or did they give it to you because, hey, there's really something to work here and you got to cut your teeth on something?
Yeah, no, I'm sure I was given it because they thought it was a dry hole. They wanted to give away this case if they knew what was going to happen.
Well,
career case, there's no way.
you're being a little humble there, as we're going to find out here in just a few minutes.
All right. Well, so take us through. So you get this dropped onto your desk. What do you start doing?
No, obviously, we start doing our general investigation, right? We want to see who Carlos Restrepo is. He lives in Miami. We identify him. And, obviously, they hand us their intercepted calls. So we start doing our investigation and looking at his phone. And obviously, again, we've got the recorded calls on the phone, typical federal Title III. And I don't know if I'm sure other people have mentioned, it's not easy getting a Title III. A telephone intercept federal takes an act of God. It really is. You know, people think their rights are being violated out there. To get a Title III intercept in the U.S. takes months of work and a lot of writing. And it is really hard work. So what we do, we start looking at this phone, and the problem we're seeing is, and this was technology at the time, and cell phones, and it's kind of, you look at technology, and we'll talk later on about, you know, I'm working for Magnet Forensics now, a forensics company, and we're dealing with phones daily. You know, our software is used to analyze phones. And at the time, these phones, SIM cards just came out. This is in 2000 now. So SIM cards just came on the market. But what really helped us, and you're going to see as this investigation continues, is that if you bought a SIM card, it had to be for your company. So if you had a VoiceStream phone, you had to buy VoiceStream SIM cards. So you couldn't jump from AT&T to other companies. You had to stay with the same phone company. But we found out that Restrepo was pretty much getting rid of his phone every week, changing his phone. And anybody that's done a Title III intercept knows you're not going to get up on a phone in a week. I mean, 2 to 3 months, if you're lucky, federal.
And you know something, Tim, the other thing too, the other problem at that time, and I think it was Louis Free who tried to address it when he was at the Bureau. It's like, quit thinking about tapping a phone. Talk about tapping a person, because exactly to that point, if all they do is they change their phone every week, you've just created a paperwork nightmare that every week you've got to go back and go back through this whole process again. It's about the person, not the device. But for too long, right, they were so focused on the device.
Yeah, and actually that's called a roving wire intercept. And there weren't many at the time. It was kind of rare to get one, but that's what we pursued. I had an aggressive prosecutor, Dave Weinstein, best prosecutor I probably ever had, works private practice now, but he became chief of narcotics later on, but just an amazing, aggressive, very smart prosecutor. And he worked with me, and we had identifying all these phones, and every phone you identify, right? You've got when was it started? How much time's on it? When was the last incoming call? Not only do you got to show calls to the target or the targets you know, but to other targets you don't know, right? You've got to give justification. You want to intercept this phone because, let's say you have an informant and my informant calls your phone. Well, we're already getting that conversation. We don't need that. You got to prove to the court why he's got to identify other people he's calling. So you really got to do your work on those phones and show that other numbers are other bad guys out there. So it really takes a lot of work. But basically we ended up getting a roving wire intercept on him. It started in June 8th of 2001. So this is about 6 months later now. You'll identify a phone, right? You'll send it to the prosecutor and your affidavit. I think our affidavits were like 100 pages long. So these are works of art. I mean, they're long, a lot of information, showing all the phones, what he's on now. And we get to the prosecutor. Of course, prosecutor's going to review it. He's going to send it back and forth. After he gets done with it, it's got to go up to Main Justice in Washington, D.C. The lawyers up in Main Justice got to review it. They got to approve it before he can get up on a federal wire or something. Now you're a couple weeks in and the phone's changed again, right? So it was just impossible. So again, we were able to write this roving intercept for actually Carlos Restrepo and any cellular telephones utilized by Carlos Restrepo. So it didn't matter what phone number it was. We could intercept any phone he had. So that was the basis of our Title III intercept. And again, we got that. This is now about 6 months later, June of 2001. We got that wire intercept from the judge.
If I can just, I don't want to go backwards here, but just to add on to what you said about getting a wiretap on anybody's phone. And when we say Title III, everyone, that we're talking about wiretaps. It was so difficult because it is one of the most invasive investigative tools we have available to us. And you're really required to exhaust all other investigative means just before you even start thinking about a Title III. And as an example, when I was in Greensboro, and in my whole career, I only did one Title III, and that was in North Carolina. That's how work intensive they are. But to meet the requirements that we've exhausted all of our means, we even suited up in ghillie suits, went out, and this was out in the country, the country in North Carolina, we're outside, not in any city. And had an agent drive us in a van, and he slowed down, and two of us bailed out of the van and went right into the woods, and we crawled, and we spent hours out there trying to get as close as we could to the suspect's house. And we actually got within sight of it, but then everybody's got dogs, and the dogs hear you, or they smell you, or they whatever, so that's the extent that you have to go to before you can get a Title III. So it's not just, hey, let's start this on a Title III. That's your last investigative means.
No, Murph, they were just screwing with you as the new guy. Hey, Murph, dress up in the suit. We're going to throw you out in the woods and get rid of you for a couple of days.
Well, this is after dogs. This is after we'd killed Escobar. They weren't screwing with me too much.
Well, you'll find even within DEA, you'll find certain divisions, especially different political divisions like California, where usually agents will go with state wire intercepts just because the federal wire intercepts are so hard to get. And the state police have an easier time even tracking orders and things. If you get a federal intercept, you've really done your work, and federal cases in general, you'll see in this case, federal cases, I didn't have one person in this case go to trial. So, you'll see how federal cases are really solid. So
it was a nightmare doing a wiretap. You wrote the affidavit, which is like writing a war piece. Then you remember Pat Medeiros up in Essex, Special Operations Division. You had to send it to Pat and let her shop review it. And then it came back to the prosecutor, and then it had to go to OEO, Office of Enforcement Operations, and the Department of Justice. It's a nightmare. It's a freaking nightmare.
Yeah, absolute nightmare for sure.
All right, so continue on this journey. So Murph is responsible for that last digression. He said, we don't want to go backwards, but there's a reason to drink. So there's your reason to drink. Digression number two.
Hey, use me anytime you want to for a reason to drink.
That's drink. So so you start getting this. So how does this start? So you start doing this, you build the stuff, you finally get the wiretap. What kind of, what are you doing in the 6 months while you're trying to get the wiretap? Is there any movement in the case?
Yeah, your typical surveillance. I mean, not a lot, you know, surveillance, following them around, just trying to get as much intel as you can on the guy. But really, it's when we get up on the telephone intercepts where we really started seeing more of the organization. He was kind of a lower level man in the organization. We really started focusing on this guy, Pedro Osorio, he was talking to. He's the one that really was drawing into our attention, that seemed a little higher up. And again, right, we're trying to develop the organization. One of the first events that really happened, it was about 2 weeks into the intercept, is Carlos Restrepo and this guy, Pedro Osorio, that we were starting to look at also. We knew they were going to the Fort Lauderdale airport and they were headed up to New Jersey. And we did surveillance on them, followed them to the airport up in Fort Lauderdale, watched them board a flight to New Jersey. And we got a hold of DEA New Jersey. And when they landed in New Jersey, DEA New Jersey took over the surveillance on them, followed them into Manhattan. And they did a bunch of different things. But ultimately, they followed them into a parking garage where they met with a car. They felt it was going to be a stash car. I think we'd picked up off the wire intercepts that they were going to be delivering something up there. But they met with this other car. DEA jumped on it. And after everything was said and done, they ended up finding 70 keys of cocaine in that car. So that was really our first hit on the case that we could tie to these guys. So
now, at that point, was that the most dope you had seized?
Yeah, I wasn't up there. But yeah, that was the most dope. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's cool to make a hit like that because it justifies all the work you're done. And you know, you're just beginning.
Oh yeah. Well, and you don't know that, right? I mean, at this point, this could have been the highlight of the case, right? You have no idea where it's headed, and you'll see this is like tip of the iceberg. I mean, this is like a sample on a case like this, and we'll talk about a sample later on. It's a pretty good story, but so anyway, we get this, they take the 70 keys and of course, Carlos Restrepo and Osorio, Pedro Osorio, returned back to Miami. And I think they arrested whatever mopes they had in the car at the time that had these 70 keys. Again, it was a stash car. They weren't directly there. It was being done without their presence. You know, it was a handover. So that was really the first hit. And it wasn't probably a few weeks later, July 20th, we had the second one again where it was, this time it was just Carlos Restrepo, but we knew he was going to be flying up to Chicago. We followed him to the Fort Lauderdale airport. And again, watch him get on a plane. He heads to Chicago, DEA Chicago. And this is what's great about DEA, right? We can operate anywhere. DEA Chicago follows him off the plane. They follow him to a hotel. He enters the hotel with a suitcase and he leaves a little bit later with a duffel bag out of this hotel. Same day, he goes back to the airport. They follow him to the airport and they did an airport interdiction stop on him. And they end up getting $70,000 of cash. It was rolled up and stashed in clothes. So again, just building our case against these guys right now. We got $70,000 seizure, again, up in Chicago. This actually, though, this seizure, as you see, as we get later in the case, this is where we first start seeing Sandra come into play. And this was related to Sandra, the queen of the Pacific down in Mexico. But we didn't know it at the time. But
well, and that's the goal of these investigations, is you want to continually climb the ladder, get to the higher levels, get it, you know, ultimately you want to get to the very top, the source of supply. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you take the main guy out. Did you take the organization? Not always. Sometimes you get parts of the organization, but man, when you take them all out, that's pretty significant.
But the way you get their attention, right? You can take their dope, but once you start taking their money.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. You can make
them cry. Another thing you'll see is, and you get different types of agents out there, but there's agents, they get a hit, 70 keys, they move on to the next case, right? Not everybody tries to work the case to the next level, but to me, that's the excitement of it, right? I mean, you could have a case in North Dakota that ties back to Chicago, that ties back to Mexico, that ties to the cartel in Colombia. There's nothing to stop you, right? But not everybody has that drive and energy, you know, take the 70 keys, let's call it a day and let's go to the next case, right? It's easy to do, so.
There's a saying in DEA, little cases, little problems, big cases, big problems, no cases, no problems.
It is so true.
And no cases, no promotions, no cases.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have some splaining to do when inspections come around if you don't have any cases.
You can't make a case? Oh, okay. We have the job for you. It's over in FBI.
I like the way you said that.
Yeah.
Swing.
Hey, we have to, it's our one token reach out to the FBI. Look, they're our friends, but state law requires us to make fun of the FBI at least once on every podcast. So there's our time. We've met our statutory obligation. So, all right. So you start, how does the cash now, does Restrepo, does he turn? Does he roll?
No, they just let him go. I mean, you know, we want to keep, we're on obviously Title III intercepts, the last thing, or phone intercepts, the last thing we want to do is wreck our case. So they just take the money and let him go. And that's typical on these types of cases.
But so how did you guys play it off to where he didn't think that this was because of your Title III and your surveillance and it was more just a chance interdiction? Did you do kind of a walled off thing? Did you have the airport police do it and take it, or were you guys involved directly in the seizure?
No, I'm sure they just had the airport police do it. I wasn't up there. I don't recall at the time, but that's generally how we would operate. And we do that on a lot of Title III's, right? You know, car headed north with heroin, have the troopers pull it over, just take the dope, and D is not involved.
Have the troopers pull it over because they know troopers are going to get the damn job done.
They know they have the time because they're not changing the tire or running, getting somebody some gas for their car. That's what
you're thinking
know.
About the fire department. those are the ones that have time. All right. So anyway, but back to you here, Tim. So you've got the seizure. So how does that seizure generate activity on the Title III to where you start getting this good stuff?
Yeah, well, basically at this point, I mean, those are two seizures. But really what we did at this point, based on the intercepts we had with Pedro Rosario, we kind of backed off of Carlos Restrepo, and we decided to spin up on Pedro Rosario and his phones. And again, we had the conversations off of Restrepo's phone, right? So we had the dirty calls we needed. And we had, and Restrepo, on Pedro Rosario's phone, we had target numbers in Mexico, Colombia. He looked like a bigger fish that we really wanted to go after. But the same thing, he was changing his phone every single week. We actually wrote a Title III again, roving intercept affidavit. Again, act of God. These things are massive, a lot of work. But we got, just jump forward a little bit here. We were up on his phones for 3 months. And just to give you an idea, we were up on 20 cellular telephones over 3 months. But this was so easy at the time, because what he would do is, as soon as his phone would go dead, we had a contact we could call up in New Jersey in VoiceStream, and we'd call her up immediately. This was usually after 12, 24 hours his phone was dead, and say, hey, you guys got this, we got this, your phone just went dead. We want to know within the last 24 hours, what phone in your company that your company owns called this Mexico number, this Colombia number, and this New York number. And we'd be up on his new phone. We never missed the phone one time. And what this order allowed us to do, this roving wire intercept, allowed us to get on any phone that we felt was his phone without a judge's permission. So we could just go phone to phone. And using that way of doing things, we'd never get up on a bad phone. It was always his. But I mean, you think about it, who's going to be calling the same Colombia, Mexico number, New York number in the same day? So
the predictability really well. About it worked in your favor, because he thought he was being smart by saying, hey, I'll get rid of my phone. But the thing is, he's got to call the same numbers each time.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And obviously with today's technology, with WhatsApp and encrypted messaging and all the things that exist today,
it's kind of a nightmare.
A lot harder to do. But yeah, it's a nightmare. Even changing phone companies, right? What was really amazing when these SIM cards came out too, you could go into an AT&T store and say, give me a free SIM card. And they were handing them out like candy. And all you had to do was activate it and put money on it. So you could get phone numbers anytime you wanted. But again, we were lucky because it had to be the same company at the time. But SIM cards were kind of the Wild West back then.
All right. So keep going there. So you've done some good work here so far, Tim, but that's not the end of the road here.
No, not at all. So now we start intercepting Pedro Rosario. And this is where the fun really begins. You know, we hear him start negotiating loads. And we can tell he's talking about cocaine, but he's talking with people. And
before you get too far into that, I'm sorry, I want to interrupt because I want to ask one question. You got 20 phones going at one time. How many people on the back end do you have in your Title III or your wiretap? How many people do you got that are supporting now the operation to listen to these calls, transcribe them, and do that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it was 20 phones, but it was one phone at a time. So it was only one phone being listened to at a time.
Okay.
Sometimes it'd be two or three phones. It would usually go dead, but if it was still had money on it, we would have to keep it active. But he was only using one phone at a time. But yeah, I mean, being in Miami, and Steve could tell you, we had full-time translators on board in the listening suite. So usually there'd be an agent there with two or three translators listening to the phone and alerting us to anything that we made to, you know, respond to or go out on surveillance on or react on. But
And there's a key right there in that if you're going to do a wiretap, you want it in a foreign language because you can get funding to hire translators and you don't have to assign agents to sit there 24 hours a day.
Yeah, if it's English, your agent's got to sit and listen to these phones. But Miami was so much Spanish that Miami actually had an office in the office that was managed by a contract company of translators. So Miami was really easy to run a wire intercept.
Right. So you've got your translators are getting everything for you. They're letting you know anything that's actionable. So how often are you guys having to respond to stuff that's coming in over the Title III as they're translating it? Is it like every day? Is it every hour? Or is it like, do you have fits and spurts?
Not really. It comes and goes. It's not that frequent. And the thing is, you know, everybody in the group has their cases going on. Everybody's busy. So it's hard running a case like this when, you know, the Title III comes up, people are getting tired, right? Like, okay, hey, it looks like they're running out here. Let's go follow them. And we end up following his car and his wife going to the mall. And, you know, she's meeting with some people. And agents in the group, they tend to get a little tired after a few of those surveillances where nothing's really happening. Because, again, right, we're trying to learn what he's doing and who's who. So, fortunately for me at the time, I'd put a tracking device on his vehicle. He just got a – and at the time, this guy – and, Murphy, you probably know Pembroke Pines. He just bought just west of the mall. There's a brand-new community. So he just spent $450,000, which probably is about $800,000 now, in a brand-new house. Got a brand-new BMW X5. So he was living the good life. He had a wife and daughter. And, you know, so I put a tracking device on his car. So, you know, many times I would just go up by myself, put up the laptop in my side seat, put up the tracker, and I'd do a one-man surveillance on him, see where he was going, watch what he was doing. Because, again, you know, everybody's got their own cases going on. It's hard tying up your whole group all the time just to sit there and follow his wife going to the mall and different things. So, but yeah, it was really sporadic. But I think the bigger thing we were getting was the intel off his phone, which was, we knew that he was controlling cocaine coming from Colombia through Mexico to the U.S., usually headed up to Chicago, Detroit, New York. And then we had enough calls where we knew that he was moving money back through Mexico to Colombia. I mean, that was really what we got off the phone. So we didn't get any more seizures off his phones. It was pretty much intelligence and stuff that we could use for the indictment. Because every time he talked about moving cocaine, and that's what's really nice about the federal system. A lot of states don't have good conspiracy charges, but federally we have some great conspiracy charges. If he talks about moving drugs and taking actions to move the drugs, he could be charged with those drugs, even though they never existed. So,
that's, you know, an act in furtherance, an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. You know, now you got him.
Between two or more conspirators. You know, and one thing, it's not common that agents would go out alone like Tim's talking about here, doing surveillance. But if you saw something, your entire group's just a phone call away, right?
Yep, 100%, yeah.
I mean, if you got something hot going, everybody will jump on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could get people if you needed them. It was more me, actually. I've always been like that my whole career. I hate having people do things or be tied up on my cases. I've never liked having to tie people up when they have stuff to do. And guys wouldn't mind. It's just always the way I've always operated, right? I hate having people do things that I can do. So, you know, and you probably know too, Murph, like I could have people write reports for me, but then, you know, you sit and wait on them or they're not done the way you want. Or so I've even when I was doing a Title III intercept, I did a lot of the analytical work myself. We had analysts and you could go down to the, you know, you could go down to the office where all the analysts were, and you could have them do the information on the phones and write up the analytical work. But I'd rather just sit and do it myself. I know what I'm doing. No one's going to be done. And so a lot of the work on this case, I just did myself. I wouldn't even ask for the analysts or anyone to get involved. But
wow. I tell you what, there's no better team than a good, hardworking agent and an excellent analyst who complement each other. That's a tough team to beat.
Yep, that's for sure.
So you're getting all of this great stuff, but so what are you doing with it? Like you said, you're not getting the dope. It's kind of like it's more just intelligence now, conspiratorial stuff. How do you make this thing move forward?
Well, at this point, and I forget how many months later this was, but we went, again, great prosecutor. We went down and stood in front of the grand jury down in the federal courthouse in Miami, and we got a federal indictment charging Pedro Zorio and Carlos Restrepo with Title 21, USC 846, which is our federal drug charges. And it was based upon the wire intercepts we had. And again, the cocaine seizures and the money seizures and the current wire intercepts. And basically we charged them with 400 kilograms of cocaine based on what they talked about. So they were facing charges on 400 kilos. I think it was a 20-year sentence they were looking at. And we got search warrants for Pedro Osorio's house. So that was really the next big step in this. This was probably going into, this was probably early November that we'd gotten the warrant. Our telephone intercepts actually were expiring November 11th. We had information off the intercepts. It looked like Pedro Osorio was going to be leaving the country to Colombia. I was getting a heavy push from my management to get him arrested before he left. For them, it was the highest level target we had. He was running the organization. He was the highest level member we had on our intercepts. So they really didn't want to lose this opportunity to get him. And my attitude was actually completely opposite, right? He just bought a brand new house. He's got a BMW. His wife and kids are here. He's coming back. And fortunately for me, he ended up leaving before we could get him. And you'll see it really worked out in my favor. So he flies down to Colombia. I think he was down there maybe a week or two. And he came back. When was that? He came back right before December. I think it was late November. I had him back in Miami at his house. So on December 4th, this is December 4th of 2001 now, we went and did the search warrant at his house out in Pembroke Pines. So hit the door and locked him up.
Did you find anything in the house worthwhile?
Well, not related to drugs, but related to his meetings down in Colombia, yeah. I mean, we found all kinds of documents and things. And this goes back to, we knew he had talked about moving a big load. And through this arrest and documents and things we found, we knew there was going to be a big load leaving Colombia, headed to Mexico. And in his binder, we found things like he had the call signs of the vessels we're going to be using. He had the longitude, latitude of where the Colombian and Mexican vessels were going to do the exchange at sea. He had the 2 gigahertz frequency radio communications that the boats were going to be using. So again, we found quite a bit of information about this load that was going to be transferred. We played him, obviously, the recordings. He knew he was done. So he ended up obviously pleading guilty and it went from there. But
what did you do to keep if he's arrested and news gets back, don't they just change the whole shipment? I mean, how do you keep this thing working so that the shipment and the boat and the ships, everything remains in play?
Well, yeah, it was pretty unique, but he ended up going to the court that night, sealed courtroom, and pled guilty. Within 12 hours of being arrested, he pled guilty. And I had a federal judge.
I like those kind of cases. Yeah.
Holy cow.
And I had a federal judge trust me enough to hand him to my custody after pleading guilty. And he went back to the DEA field office and lived in our office for 2 months on a blow-up air mattress 24/7. So we were buying on McDonald's, playing video games, and we lived with him for 2 weeks.
Was it 2 weeks or 2 months?
2 weeks. Yeah, for 2 weeks.
And this was in the Southern District of Florida?
Yep. Obviously, we couldn't let anyone know that he had been arrested or things would have went south. So.
Well, and that's the whole – so that gets back to my point. So to everybody else, he's still in play. He's still doing stuff. But how do you handle his family? Because he's, wife
– He talked to them. The wife would come – actually, the wife would come to the Miami field office with the kid, and we'd sit at the picnic table and have lunch with the family. So, the wife was on board, and – she knew what they had to do. And
was this down at the Coger Center, or is this out in?
Yeah,
in
West? This is the Coger Center. Yeah, the picnic table between the two buildings. Yeah.
Holy cow!
I got some slack for that, but he's out there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man.
He's out there with a federal arrestee in between the buildings.
Well, it probably wasn't them having the meal. It was the conjugal visit that everybody was complaining about, right?
Yeah, that too, probably.
And whatever you got to do to keep the guy happy, right? Speaking of loads, let's get back to the ship. Let's get back to the other load.
Oh, that was terrible.
Sorry. But hey, I'm unpaid comedian. Thank you very much. But so to, you know who else this reminds me of too, Steve?
Yeah.
Who was the master of the F-bomb that came from DEA that worked the case?
Oh, gee.
Tommy Cedric.
Tommy Cedric.
Remember how they kept that dude in play for quite a while, for months?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy, And the thing I like about it, that's the lengths that we're willing to go to, especially if you can get the court behind you, a federal judge, to make these cases, because that's what you got to do to infiltrate these organizations.
Well, obviously, because of, we knew there was going to be a multi-ton load. We knew it was going to be leaving in the next week or two. We knew meetings happened in Colombia about this load. We had a pretty good destination. We had the coordinates of where the transfer was going to take place. So it wasn't going to be a couple months, and we just needed those couple weeks, fortunately. Obviously, I think a big thing was, and like I said, it's not often that a federal judge just gives you a guy and, you know, he's been now charged and here, take him. You know, my office, my management, you know, my supervisor at the time wasn't behind this entire thing. He thought that he just should have been kept inside and not released. And I had to go to the ASAC, the second level management, and say, yeah, there's bigger fish. I mean, we've got to do this. And they went on board with me and did it. But
he's incentivized also to work this off because
20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a specific rule, right, that you'll tell us about that you can invoke, that if they show significant cooperation, they can work off their time.
Yep. 100%. 100%.
Absolutely.
So basically, I mean, based with him being with us, we knew, I mean, obviously calls were made and things. We knew that this load had left Buenaventura, Colombia. It was leaving out of Buenaventura. We didn't have a lot of good information. We knew it was on the route. I think it was, I can't remember how many days in, we had actually got information that it already met and the load had exchanged. So we knew that it had actually been transferred to the Mexican vessel. We knew they were going to be using Zodiacs to run it back and forth in the middle of the night between the vessels. So we had good intel on that.
What's a Zodiac? Can you explain that?
These little speedboats, motorboats. So,
rigid. They're the kind of rib boats, the rigid inflatable boats, you know, that can. Hey, so you had one ship depart Colombia, and then it's meeting with another ship that's going to be the ship that, yeah, Mexican ship that'll then bring it to its final destination.
Bring it into Mexico, yeah. Some other, before I continue with that, some other information we'd gotten after his arrest was that money that was seized in Chicago belonged to this woman named Sandra, who eventually we obviously figure out Sandra Beltran Avila, you know, Queen of the Pacific. It was from 100 kilos that had been delivered into Chicago, and that was money that was being brought back. So that's really where she came into our radar. And then we also obtained information about two Colombian traffickers that were living in Guadalajara. This guy, Juan Diego Espinosa and Mauricio Espinosa. They were brothers. Juan Diego was Sandra's basically paramour. It was her, you know, illegal husband that she was living with. So
Her what kind of husband? What'd you call him?
Well, not married. You know, they call him a paramour or whatever you want to call it.
What'd you call him?
Unlegal husband?
Unlegal husband. Illegal.
I've never heard that term.
Illegal, right?
Okay. Just curious.
So it's her side hustle. It's her side, you know,
her squeeze.
Yeah, but he's actually, he's the one obviously tied, and we find out later, these are the two that are tied into the North Avaya cartel. So Juan Diego and Mauricio, you know, she's sleeping with this guy, living with this guy, and he's really the connection to the North Avaya cartel over in Colombia, which at that time was still being run by Diego Montoya, who was basically like the new Pablo Escobar in Colombia, probably one of the biggest names that came after Pablo, so besides Varela. But that was just additional information we gotten from them. And again, we had Mauricio Espinosa in Colombian in Guadalajara. We had Juan Diego. Now we started looking at Sandra Beltran. We knew she was a Mexican. We start getting more and more information on her. I'll talk about her in a minute. They also identify just general names at this point, but these people really become big later on. There was a broker out of Cali, Colombia by the name of Ramon, the supplier for the North Avaya cartel. They knew him as Laner. And then really the big kingpin in Mexico that was receiving this load, this guy Julio, they knew him as El Cantante. But again, at this point, we didn't know the names. And eventually we indict and figure out all these people. But again, it's a game of just working your way up and up and up as we go and arrest people and extradite them and move on and on. So anyway, we're back to the shipment now. So at this point, we had gotten notification, obviously over some phones, that the transfer had just taken place. This was like a week before Christmas. So the U.S. Navy launches a P-3 aircraft up. And at the same time this was happening, information came through from the Mazatlan, Mexico office. A couple agents down there had a case. And they had boarded this fishing vessel twice previously with information that had drugs, and it did not have drugs on it. It was empty. They had information that this vessel was headed out to do another load run. And this was coinciding with what we were doing. And we passed our information to the Joint Intelligence Center down in Key West. They passed theirs to the Joint Intelligence Center out in the West Coast in California. And these two ended up crossing paths. So now they had information coming from two different directions, from Mazatlan, Mexico office, DEA, and from us, that these these bullets may be in the area doing this load. So
that gives a lot of reliability and credibility.
Yeah. So how do you deconflict that? I mean, because you want to make sure not, I mean, they're going to look at it, right? But you're the case agent, right? So no matter what, this is still yours?
Yeah, obviously, with the amount of information and the cartel members, they didn't have any direct information. They just knew that a boat was maybe getting a load of drugs. And again, they're not going to charge in Mexico. We're going to charge domestic in the U.S. So that never became an issue. They worked really good with us. So the Navy does, they put up this P-3 aircraft, and they locate a vessel. They think it's the vessel. It's the name on it's the fishing vessel of Macel. They see it in the area. Matches kind of everything. We were given with coordinates and things. So this is now, again, a week before Christmas. So they launch the USS Mobile Bay destroyer out of San Diego to do the intercept. And what they'll do is they'll send a U.S. Naval destroyer vessel out, but they'll have a group of Coast Guard, they call them the LEADET team, Coast Guard personnel on the boat, because the Navy can't do U.S. law enforcement. So the Coast Guard is the one who actually does the boarding and the interdiction and stuff. So that way there's a U.S. Law enforcement presence there. Again, the Navy can't do it. So,
but you've got some jurisdiction issues to work through too, right? Because you go from international waters to Mexican waters. They are never going to make it into U.S. waters for you guys to get a hold of them, right?
No, it gets worse than that. The boat's flying a Mexican flag. So the U.S. destroyer gets out there and, we find out it's got a Mexican flag on it. So we basically got to write the Office of International Affairs out of Washington, D.C., and the State Department got a request from the government of Mexico, a letter of no obligation to board this vessel. So we need their permission to get on this boat. And considering this boat had been boarded twice previously, that wasn't an easy ask. So
how did you convince them?
Well, again, that was up to the embassy down there. I know there was a bunch of back and forth exchange, but I think the embassy put enough pressure on finally that they cooperated. So we did get cooperation finally, and they gave us authorization to board this boat. So,
and just to give a shout out to our agents there in Mexico, what a tough job! One of the hardest places in the world to work as a DEA agent. But that's the beauty of having them there. They have the connections, so they can go to the right people to get permission to board these vessels. We all know corruption is rampant down there, but they do a fantastic job.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And then, I kind of got a chronological layout here. I just read over it. Some of you, if you want, it's kind of interesting though. So this is from the actual U.S. Navy. So this starts on December 17th now. The aircraft sends a floor image back to the vessel for them to view. They get a visual on the vessel. Helicopter positively identified the vessel. The vessel changed its direction. Now it's slowed to 6 knots. And now it again changed its direction, sped up to 11 knots. The U.S. Navy vessel began questioning the Macel, completed their questioning. Now this is on December 18th. This is the next day. They've notified them by a VHF radio that their intent to board the vessel with the government of Mexico approval. They did board the vessel. They commenced searching the vessel. They requested permission to bring U.S. Navy personnel on board to assist. So this goes on. This is December 19th now. December 20th, they swapped the night crew out. They began pumping seawater out of the fish holding tanks. They requested permission to use the U.S. Navy engineering team to assist because they had to go into some of these tanks with scuba apparatus because of the gas and stuff. They began mapping out the fuel tanks and the transfer systems. This is on the 20th now. So now we're almost 3 days in, and I was getting notification back that they had done ion scans for drugs, and they were coming up negative. And at this point, you can imagine the guy living with us in the office, he's like, I'll get her paddle boat and go out there myself. I mean, he was getting crazy. Like,
now, were they really fishing while they were doing this, or did they just have like old fish that were just laying in there?
Well, I don't know. They had a fish tank full, so... they assess the water ballast tanks. They open the forefront tank, and this just goes on and on and on. They eventually find, after emptying the fuel tanks and the fish tanks and that, they go in and they actually start finding drugs. And there's a great video. I sent you a video, phenomenal video of the whole boarding by the Coast Guard, the search, them guys bringing up the kilos.
The video is deceptive. The video makes it look like they did it like in 30 minutes. And you're saying we're going on 3 days right now.
Yeah, well, they're just showing you the part where they found the drugs on the video. Yeah, they didn't show you the first 3 days on the boat. But while all this was going on, Mexico also sent I forgot what the name of the vessel was, but they sent their own military destroyer out there basically to take control of the load and take over the load. So they arrived, they stayed behind our vessel. They didn't board right away. They waited for us to do our job. But again, the Mexican Navy was now out there too with their vessel.
Where are you at when this is going on? Do you get to go out to the scene or are you stuck back in the office?
No, I'm in the office with our friend and listening to all this and getting updates, but this is now about the end of the third day or fourth day when I get notifications they found drugs, and all of a sudden I start getting, they're up to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 7,000, 9,000, like 9,300 kilos of cocaine, which at the time I think was the fourth biggest seizure the Coast Guard ever had at sea. It was massive. I mean, on one vessel.
Damn.
Yeah, we couldn't believe it. We were just like,
well, and when you watch the video, which I did, and you look at it, you go, these guys, I mean, if you think, all you have to do is watch like the shows that they have on Nat Geo, like the Customs and Border Protection shows that they have where they show people coming across the borders, you know, and they're searching vehicles. There's a lot of places to hide stuff in vehicles. But when I saw these guys having to go to ships and look at these huge container ships, and then you're thinking this, there is a lot of, even it's a good sized boat, but there's a lot of places you can hide dope in that.
So, and you see on the video, I mean, they had just tons of communication equipment, computers, faxes. They had the boats we knew, the Zodiac boats, these single engine boats to run the loads back and forth. I mean, everything matched up with what he said. I think there was 20 crew members on board this. It was a big boat, and you'll see in the videos, it's a really large boat. Basically, the Mexican Navy then came on board, took over control of the boat. This was kind of funny. I always joke about this, but they... You know, working up in D.C. and in the U.S., you get a sample of a case. It's usually a gram or two. Well, they sent the sample back with the U.S. Coast Guard to San Diego of 20 kilos of cocaine. So it was one bundle of 20 kilos. And in the U.S., they'd be a career case. And that was my sample that came back.
And that's what you were saying earlier when you were talking about samples. You know, you have a few grams here and there. That's when you said, no, I got a sample for you, 20 kilos.
Well, it gets better because me and my partner were in Miami. This was a little later on now after all this happened, but we had to go out to San Diego and pick up the sample to bring it back to Miami. So me and my partner fly out to San Diego. We go out to the Carlsbad office, and we each put 10 kilograms in a duffel bag. So we're each carrying 10 kilograms. And of course, you know, in an airport, we don't go through security. We go around security. So we walk around security with 20 kilos of cocaine, put it in the overhead compartment of American Airlines and fly back to Miami.
Oh, jeez.
20 kilos of cocaine in the overhead compartment. Thank God that didn't bust open.
The public never knows.
Never knows.
So, pardon, pay no attention here. Goes through the x-ray scanners. It's all good, right? You're flying commercial with 20 kilos of coke.
Yep. 20 kilos of coke in an overhead compartment.
Did you go to the bathroom and leave it unattended?
No. Somebody was always sitting in the seat.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll tell you who's got the bladder of a freaking elephant or whatever. I was flying back from Pakistan, and the guy that was the regional security officer or the assistant RSO there at the embassy, he was flying back to the United States. I think his tour was over, but he had a diplomatic pouch. He put it above him. We're all up in the business class area, the 747. He never once left it and went to the bathroom because I can't sleep on flight, so I'm awake the whole time. We're flying from Pakistan, from Islamabad to London. He never got up once, and he was drinking 10 times more than I was. He's having pound on those free drinks. I think he's going, thank God I'm out of this place, you know?
He got one of those pee bottles tied to his leg.
Probably, yeah, along with 20 kilos of dope, you know, in a diplomatic.
Who knows what's in there?
So, but we keep talking about the Queen of the Pacific. How did it get the name? I mean, where does she come into this now?
Yeah, so just to finish up with the seizure. So me and my partner, we actually fly out. This was my first time going overseas. So we fly out to Mazatlan right after the seizure happened. And we meet with the Mazatlan agents. And again, I'd never been overseas. And Steve could probably, I mean, this is my first time with the government overseas. And it was like, I was just amazed. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like right out of the movies. I mean, these guys pull up, pick me up in an armored vehicle. And again, Mazatlan was one of our only offices. You can't have any dependents. You got to be single. And there's no government consulate there. They're by themselves in the Sinaloa, the most dangerous state of Mexico. pick me up in an armored vehicle. We come pulling up to the office. Literally, these guys have the gates open. Before we pull up, slam the gates shut. And it was just something out of the Wild West, like I've never seen in my life. But then that evening, they take me to their homes, and I'm just like, are you kidding me? This is like out of James Bond. I mean, these mansions on the golf course with jacuzzis and swimming pools and security guards. And I'm like, "Are you? This is how people live overseas?" This was the first exposure I had. This is amazing. I was like,
yeah, it's not like that everywhere, but it's not too bad. Was the agent you were working, that wasn't Mike Chavarria, was it?
That was Mike Chavarria, yeah. So I was down there with Mike and Ramon de la Garza and Eddie Bordon. Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna get Mike on the show maybe next year. He's got unbelievable stories in Mexico.
Yeah, it was Mike and his team that worked this with me. So yeah, really good guys. Yeah.
Outstanding agent. I mean, one of the best I've ever met.
So anyway, we jump in armored vehicles and we head down to Manzanillo in the south of Mexico where they're bringing this load in. So we go halfway, we stop in Puerto Vallarta, spend a night there, and then we finish up finally down in Manzanillo. And again, we get down to Manzanillo and we end up staying in this most beautiful all-inclusive resort I've ever been in my life. I mean, it was quite the experience. It was an eye-opener for me. We had a good time. It was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. But go ahead.
You know, there's a saying in DEA, you can work the job or you can let the job work you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, why not you work the job and let them pay you to go do stuff like that?
That's right. But we go to the port the next day, and they make a big dog and pony show out of. So they got the big vessel coming in, the Macel, and they've got the soldiers on it, and they've got the military destroyer behind it escorting it, the Mexican military. They've got soldiers lined up in formation. They've got the Azteca TV stations out there. So they made a big show out of this whole thing, you know, offloading it. And that they spent probably a good 8 hours sampling it. They sampled every double brick kilo of 9,000 kilos. So they cut it open, tested it, took a sample out. This probably took 8 hours. I mean, you see it on the video. It was
saw that in the video. I'm going,
yeah.
I mean, after a couple kilos, you do some random samples. It's like,
right.
You're not going to all this work to hide a kilo of baking soda.
Well, then they did a press conference on one of the destroyers, another destroyer that was parked there. We went into the destroyer. They did a press conference for the media, and you could tell some of these people, some of these higher ups, they didn't have happy faces. I mean, you could tell
somebody's going to be in trouble.
Oh yeah, some people were going to be in a lot of trouble. So after they sample it and do all this testing, they put it into a semi-container, and they literally take a welder and they weld it shut so nobody could get in. And that's when we leave, and that's when the bribes start. And we were getting it through, you know, cooperators and different people that the bribes are coming in to get these drugs back, obviously. I think it was a week later So what happened was they were going to burn it. They put it out on a pallet, and it's a massive. I got good pictures of it, but they put it on this huge pallet, 9,000 kilos, and they're going to burn it. And Ramon de la Garza from the Mazatlan office got to go down and actually sample it to make sure they didn't change the packages. So he got to sample it before it was burned, do random samples, and make sure all the coke was really still there. Because otherwise, you know, they just would have put something out there and made it look like it was
baking soda. They put baking soda in there. Yeah.
Well, and you know, for our listeners, you know, you hear about the corruption in Mexico. It's true. It's real. It's been going on. It's not something that just happened over the last few years. It's been going on for years and years. And the cartels are taking over control down there, which is, you know, it's politics doesn't want you to talk about that anymore. But that's the truth. And the fact that I'm sure there were quite a few high ranking people that were killed over this. I saw in your presentation,
prosecutor was killed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was about a week later. The federal prosecutor in Mexico was found in his car, shot up with AK-47. So he was murdered over that burning of the drugs. But why
would people be so interested in trying to get that dope back? Because the street value of it was $185 million.
Yeah. No, that was wholesale. No, street value would have been
wholesale. Oh my God. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, would have been street value would have been. I mean, that load was probably worth what then? Over $1 billion then by the time it got cut up?
Oh, I'm sure. Easily. Yeah.
Okay. So, what would you do for $1 billion? Well, I'd probably bribe somebody, get that thing. I saw him welding that. I'm going, damn. Yeah. It's going to be hard. It's going to take some work to get that thing unwelded, you know, and get to the dope in there.
Yeah. I'm sure it took a metal saw for that. But. So anyway, after they burned the drugs, we got a hold of the Guadalajara office, and And they initiated a joint investigation on Sandra, Mauricio, and Juan Diego down in Guadalajara. And again, you got to be really careful, obviously, how what information you pass on these investigations working with the Mexican counterparts.
Because it gets leaked.
Yeah, obviously. So the counterparts in Guadalajara actually go up on wire intercepts on let's see, who I think they went up on Mauricio and Juan Diego. And through the intercepts, they just started finding all kinds of stuff. They found two businesses in Guadalajara that Mauricio owned. They found the million-dollar home in Guadalajara that Sandra and Juan Diego were living in with 20 luxury vehicles outside. Another million-dollar vacation home in Puerto Vallarta, and a bunch of other stuff. I actually went down one time. I flew into Guadalajara, and we drove from Guadalajara over to Puerto Vallarta through the beautiful tequila fields. And again, another awesome experience. But we get over there and we wanted to check out this million-dollar vacation home he had in Puerto Vallarta. And of course, we get up to a gated community. And of course, the good Mexican agents I'm with convince these guys to let us in. And we get up to the house and there's gardeners working outside. And of course, these great Mexican, some of them Mexican, some of them U.S., but some of these great agents I'm working with convince these gardeners to let us in his house because we're looking at buying a very similar house like his. So we're running around inside the house, checking out his cabinets, checking out the house. And I think somebody might have left in his nice big hardwood bed a message from DEA. I can't remember, but...
When you say left a message, was this carved into the wood or what?
Yeah, it could have been.
And I have no recollection of that, Senator.
Or else it was just like writing your name in the snow, maybe it rose, maybe on the feet.
Except this was a little more permanent, right? So if this message had been written, what might it have said?
It might have had our initials there. I don't know.
Kilroy was here, that old
woman. That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, probably a few more dead people, too, those poor gardeners. But
oh, man.
Yeah, stuff like that doesn't really happen. It's all a joke.
Well,
yeah,
hey,
of course.
Let's kind of, let's kind of then just kind of bring this to a close because you made a mention, though, at the beginning, and it may have been before we started recording, but you talked about you didn't go to trial on anybody, right? So at the end of this, what for you, what was the net result? How many people indicted? You know, how many people convicted? You know, kind of give us that scorecard there.
Yeah, no. So basically, cut to the rest of the indictments. And that Sandra ended up, obviously, we found out, like you were saying, a lot about her. So her, she had a family member who was Rafael Quintero, was part of her family who ran the Guadalajara cartel.
Carl Quintero? Miguel,
yeah. Rafael Carl Quintero was a family member to her. Miguel Angel Feliz Guerrero, who is serving 40 years for the DEA murder. That was her. She's a niece of him, so that's her uncle. Just really heavy tied into Juan Jose Quintero Payan was extradited for drug trafficking charges. That was her uncle. She was actually married to two prior commanders of the two prior ex-police commanders down there who were drug traffickers. Both of them were killed by sicarios. So she had this whole history of just always being tied into a lot of the drug traffickers. And again, you were saying, you know, she was all over the media and stuff. So we indicted her. We indicted Mauricio was arrested in November 12th of 2002 in Bogota. They actually spotted the Mexicans on surveillance. He fled back. So he got arrested in Bogota, came to the U.S. He pled guilty. Eventually, his brother was arrested at the same time as Sandra in the U.S. They both were brought here. They both pled guilty. We did a really good job interdicting that broker out of Cali, Colombia, Ramon. He actually had all of his fingerprints and everything removed from the entire system in Colombia. And it was through cooperation of some of the people here, we found out he had his son baptized at a church in Cali, Colombia. They went and met with a priest and they found the baptism records. And we identified him through that. He had been working drugs since 84 in New York, worked with every major cartel player you could imagine in Colombia. And in his mom's house, when he got extradited to the U.S., was brought here. In his mom's house, he had a 3/4-inch floppy disk with the last 5 years of just millions of kilos of cocaine and every load he brokered, everything laid out. And it was used by New York and Tampa and all kinds of other districts as evidence in their cases. It was incredible evidence.
What a gold mine.
Yeah, Leonard Valencia, he supplied the load. He was extradited, brought over. He cooperated. His sister was actually the mayor of Zarzal, Colombia, that was put in place by Diego Montoya. She flew to Miami to meet with us to try and help out Lehner and his two brothers who were in Mexico that we also indicted. So we were meeting with her. Some of the indicted targets I had before they got arrested, I had orders for their arrest in Mexico and Colombia. They were meeting me in Costa Rica with the attorneys to try and cooperate before they got arrested. So I was meeting a lot of these guys in Costa Rica before their arrest to see if they could, you know, kind of help themselves out. So it was a lot of indictments, a lot of indictments. Everybody was caught and brought to the U.S. and pled guilty. Nobody ever went to trial. So all in all, I mean, it was just an amazing, successful case. This case kept going after I was in Colombia. I went to Colombia because of the work I did in this case. I was traveling to Colombia probably every other month for about 2 years, working with the agents down there, identifying these people working the case. And that really helped me get my position down there. So in 2007, I got a position in Cartagena. I did 3 years in Cartagena, and then I went to Bogota for 4 years, where I really oversaw our, and ran our intercept programs down there. So. And that kind of got me into the career I'm in now with the technology. Went back to Rhode Island University, got a master's in digital forensics, and set myself up for retirement. So,
wow. And when you were in Cartagena, was Sherry Foster there by any chance?
Yeah, Sherry was there. Yep.
Guess who we've been texting back and forth with while we've been on this podcast? Sherry needs a contact. I need to tell her we're talking to you right now, but Sherry needs a contact for something she's working on. We said, hey, we'll get it to you. So I will tell her we were just on a call with
That's funny.
She's a previous guest on Game of Crimes.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, in fact, she's going to be in Orlando next week, so we're getting together for dinner with my wife and her. I'm not sure she's bringing JP down with her or not. You remember JP, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah, I lived with them for 3 years.
Hey, wait a minute, not Javier.
Right,
JP.
Yeah.
I believe he introduced chicken wings to Cartagena, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He opened his own business there.
So, question I have to ask everybody, because I did some work on Plan Colombia down in Bogota. And so, the question I always have to ask everybody: did you go eat at Montserrat?
Oh, of course. I took them to Montserrat. Actually, I take them up to a steak Casa Brava up on the mountain overlooking the city. Great restaurant if you ever get there. But
beautiful.
I did that. After I left Columbia, I went back to Boston, and then I finished in Homestead, Florida. I retired about 4 years ago, so, and really got a chance to get into my second career, my passion. I've always loved computers, and now, from what I hear, you kind of got a cyber background, but I left to go work for a forensic software company and landed the spot I'm in now at Magnet Forensics, which they're out of Waterloo, Canada, and pretty much spend my time now managing a group. We deploy their enterprise products. But it's a great company because the owner was a cop up in Waterloo, Canada, who got medical problems, had to leave the police force for a while. And this was probably about 12, 13 years ago, and didn't like the products that were out there. And he decided he wanted to do a product that, instead of basing it on the file systems, to base it on actually artifacts, and developed this product, started giving it away for free. And now today we're at 500 employees on the Canadian stock market, and probably one of the premier products out in the U.S. right now for computer forensics. So,
very cool. Yeah. Very cool.
But that's where I'm at now. So,
look at that. Start off as a little kid from a town where they only had one murder in 30 years. You go to Milwaukee. You have run-ins with Jeffrey Dahmer. Well, sort of, you know, and all that stuff. And then you end up with, you know, I mean, that is one of the largest seizures, obviously, still stands. I mean, anytime you can pull that much dope off, it's, you know what? Again, we go back to, it's not so much the dope that hurts them, it's the money. They've just lost potentially, you know, absolutely, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. That's, you want to hurt somebody, take away their money, take away their toys.
Yeah, a lot of people died in this case. Some of my indicted targets, I think it was Laner. No, it was Juan Diego and Mauricio lost two brothers in Colombia over this, got killed. One got shot and survived. Mauricio, when he was in Bogota, I went down to meet his girlfriend while he was in prison in Bogota. Supposedly, he wanted to provide some information to me. And when I met with her, she really didn't provide any information. But a couple of weeks after I left, she disappeared, was never seen again. So, you know, there was a lot of people who lost their lives over it, that's for sure.
You know, as they say in Colombia, there's a saying down there, que pena.
Yep, que pena. You go into the business.
And, you know, that's not to go off on a tangent, but I'm going to for a second. That's the thing when we speak to young people, you know, you try to get the point across to them. This is not a glamorous lifestyle. There's nothing magnificent about it. There's two ways out. You can go to prison or you can die. You just don't do 20 years and decide you're going to retire.
There's no retirement plan in the cartel.
Right, exactly. Well, there is, but
there's an expirement plan, but there's not a retirement plan. Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it.
Oh, there was one indictment I didn't mention. The biggest guy I had indicted in Mexico was this guy, actually, Julio Beltran Quintero, El Cantante. So he was receiving these loads, and he was receiving a lot of loads. He just lost a prior 20-ton load, but I had an indictment for him, and a few weeks in after the indictment, I got some pictures in there. He was shot up. Him and four federal police that were protecting him were shot up and killed. But it was a hit by El Chapo. And in fact, when they just did El Chapo up in New York, that was one of the assassins that he was charged with, or that they identified him with. But he had issues with the Sinaloa cartel, and that's all. I never got this guy. It was a cleared arrest by death. So
cleared by exception. Offender no longer available for court.
And it shuts down on the recidivism rate, doesn't it?
It cuts down on the recidivism. Well, hey, look, man, there's a ton of stuff we could probably go into, but keep with our new format and stuff. Yeah. Let's bring this to a close. But the first, you hang on, don't go anywhere. But first thing for us is this is us saluting you, saying job well done. Anytime you take 9,500 kilos or whatever you got off the street, man, that you impact society in a big way.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, for our listeners, this is another one of the true heroes that you would never have heard about if it weren't for Game of Crimes. People who are willing to leave the comfort of their homes in the United States and go work in some of the worst environments of the world to try to help protect Americans. So, Tim, God bless you, brother. It's been great to have you on here. Thank you for agreeing to do this. Thank you to your company for coming on board with us and supporting you in your interview today. We got, our listeners don't know, but we got Victor listening in, so we'll give him a shout out today from Magnet Forensics. And it's just been a true, true honor to have an old friend and a brother law enforcement, especially DEA agent, on here with us. So thank you, my friend.
No, thank you. It was great being on with you guys. Great to see you again, Steve. It's been a while, so.
It has been.
All right. Hang on with me, Tim. Don't go anywhere. As we tell everybody, this is our new format. It's our outro. So I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. If you did, show Tim how much you like him. Show Tim how much you can validate him by going to Spotify and Apple, hitting those 5 stars, and tell somebody, you're somebody, you're special, and we really like you. So hit those 5 stars over there. Also, head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. That's where we're going to post all the videos and the stuff we're talking about here. Follow us on the social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. Also, head on over to PayPal, GameOfCrimesPodcast@gmail.com or paypal.me/GameOfCrimes. But where you got to be, Murph? Where you got to be, Murph? And just, you know, where you got to be.
I don't know. Where do you got to be? I got to go to dinner in a little while. No, you need to come over and check us out on Patreon. Just give us a shot. See what you think about it. And after you go to Patreon and check it out, give us some feedback. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. You know, we want you to be happy with what we're doing. We enjoy doing it, but you're the one giving us your hard-earned cash. So let us know what your thoughts are. Constructive criticism is always welcome. And if we have a difference of opinion, not a problem. We can still be friends.
Why can't we be friends? This is our new outro music. So, hey, guys, but don't go anywhere. Hey, but you guys hang on. But everybody else, thank you once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, Great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all iqbar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.